As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to Straight Outta Cobham, the Chelsea FC podcast from The Athletic. This week we're reflecting on the win against Leeds that briefly sent the Blues top of the table. We'll look ahead to the final Champions League group assignments, a reunion with a former boss on Merseyside, answer your questions and more. Available for free wherever you get your podcasts and ad-free on The Athletic, this is Straight Outta Cobham. Welcome along then, listener. Matt Davis-Adams here with my Chelsea chaps to talk through another successful week in the world of the Blues. Liam Toomey is here.
Hello.
So too Simon Johnson.
Hello.
And not forgetting Dominic Fifield.
Hey Matt, how are you doing?
Before we begin, let me remind you that right now, if you subscribe to The Athletic, you can give another subscription as a gift for free. It's the perfect present for any football fan this Christmas. Enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all of our podcasts. Wave goodbye to 2020 and say hello to 2021 by sharing the gift of The Athletic's unrivaled football coverage for the whole year. It's the perfect present for yourself and someone else. Go to theathletic.com/ChelseaPod. That's theathletic.com/ChelseaPod and sign up. All right, first stop for us today, Saturday's win against Leeds. So the return of one of English football's fiercest rivalries took place on Saturday as Leeds United visited Stamford Bridge for the first time in 16 years. 2,000 Chelsea supporters were on hand to witness it live, as was Liam, who covered the game for The Athletic. We'll get to that first. Here's Reclusive Boy tweeting the show, though, to ask for some tidbits on the atmosphere. Liam, it sounded noisy on my telly. What was it like in the stadium, and did everything run smoothly?
Yeah, it did. I think it was all pretty seamless getting the fans into the ground. The ratio of stewards to supporters was probably a lot closer to 1-1 than it is normally at a football match. But they got all the checks done. I think they all brought all their medical questionnaires and so on, and they were all in the stadium in good time for kickoff. I think a lot of them actually tried to get in early, tried to make sure they were in the stadium early, and quite a few of them took the opportunity to give Edouard Mendy a nice little welcome. He hasn't really got to meet any of the Chelsea fans yet, as he was warming up with the goalkeepers, and then all the other players got a nice reception when they came out to warm up as well. I think there was a fair bit of excitement from a lot of the fans that were there, just at being in a football stadium again, being back at Stamford Bridge and having a chance to let this team that has been playing pretty well recently feel a bit of love. And that didn't really dull even when Patrick Bamford scored that goal out of nothing in the first 4 minutes. There was a moment of stunned silence, but then I think they got straight back behind the team, and there were only 2,000 of them in there, but the noise was pretty good, in part because of the fact that any noise they did make sort of reverberated around the empty stands and generated a decent atmosphere. But on the whole it was just really nice to have some organic noise from the stands at a football match again, and we all know it has to be done in a slow, safe way, but it was a nice step back towards normality.
Dom, I heard Gary Neville on commentary for Sky on the North London Derby on Sunday saying he could see how it could be scaled up reasonably quickly to the kind of 6,000-8,000 mark for getting supporters in. Do you think that's something that is immediately in the plans, or is it going to be stuck at 2,000 for a while?
I'd be second guessing, to be honest. I imagine it's in all the club's plans because it's in their interest to get more, that they're making losses at the moment, getting 2,000 fans in. That's not going to cover their costs for match day experience. But it's in their interest to get as many in as is possible, and as soon as possible. But you know, we can't second guess the virus, unfortunately. I mean, God knows what it's going to be like in this country post Christmas. Everything's moving in the right direction, you'd like to think. Vaccines rolling out, etc. It's only going to go one way, but it'll go that way in its own time. It's great to see supporters back. Bear in mind that at some stadia that they're still not seeing any because of the tier system. So let's bask in having a few in at the moment, and hopefully we'll move in the right direction over the rest of the season, and then hopefully next season, please, let's get back to something more approaching normality.
To the game then, Simon. Liam mentioned the Patrick Bamford early goal. Good moment for him against the club that he was contracted to, although never got to play for. But also interesting to see Chelsea having to respond to adversity after conceding a goal. Not something we've been used to of late.
No, although they have done that once before against Sheffield United, also at home. It's a very similar early goal going behind. And I think that's almost a better example of why Chelsea should be taken seriously. It's all very well winning games when everything's going your way, but to respond to adversity, to respond to a setback is a really positive sign. And let's be honest, the kind of chances that were missed, not just Timo Werner, but he obviously gets a special shout out, but Chelsea really could have won by quite a lot. I mean, Leeds looked dangerous in the first half on the counter, but you wouldn't say that Mendy was too busy despite their pressure. Chelsea, with Giroud continuing his form, and Giroud, I think I tweeted, he could have had four goals inside 20-odd minutes. He sort of, good job he wasn't in the kind of form he showed against Sevilla, if you're a Leeds fan, because, he missed a few too. What I thought was very, very significant is Chelsea becoming the first team to outrun Leeds. I think that's a really indicative of the way Chelsea played, and clearly the way they were set up by Lampard is to really outwork Leeds, and it's some feat to actually do that. And I think I heard a stat somewhere that collectively as a team, they outrun 11 kilometres more than their average this season. So it sort of shows just how motivated they were, how prepared they were for the challenge of Leeds. And I do think that Leeds, getting a win over Leeds, whilst their position in the table might suggest otherwise, I think it is a very notable victory against a very dangerous side.
Just wanted to contribute some XG news.
Obsessed.
Chelsea's XG of 4.1, according to Opta, against Leeds United was the highest for any team in a single Premier League game so far this season. So they played pretty well. I think probably Timo Werner was probably responsible for about three of those.
Well, that leads us on to Twitter questions. Got one from V Bjorn, who says, how do you explain Werner's latest difficulty with scoring goals? He wonders if it might be fatigue. I've seen a lot of people, Dom, saying, well, at least he's getting in the positions to score the goals, which is kind of the cliche that people revert to for out-of-form strikers. Is there cause for concern, or are the goals going to start to flow again for him?
I would imagine they'll start flowing again. I wouldn't be panicking. I think there's a lot in the whole position, his positioning and his instincts. I'm not sure he's a natural goal scorer by the look of things. We haven't seen, I mean, Liam or Simon might want to refute this, but he doesn't look like a natural instinctive finisher necessarily. Maybe when your confidence is maybe taking a slight dip in front of goal, then that would explain it. But he could have left that header from, was it Giroud, or was it a mixture of Leeds players and Giroud, and allowed that one to go in, really. But he was a player that was desperate to get back onto the score sheet again, and that's it was a wonderful clearance in the end, to be honest, by the crossbar. But he's got so many other assets. I don't think it's a major problem. And combined with the fact that this Chelsea team are going to create a lot of chances, I think his benefits to the team outweigh the occasional glaring miss in front of goal. And I'm sure when that first one flies back in again, he'll get back onto another scoring role. I mean, bear in mind that he was doing brilliantly well until a couple of weeks back. I mean, he was prolific. So it's not really much cause for anxiety. I know we all want players to be hitting the ground smoothly and running up cricket scores in terms of their goal tallies, but you know, the fella has got an awful lot of talent and is getting himself in the right positions, and that goal will fly in sooner rather than later.
A couple of other players who stood out, Mason Mount and Reece James. Here's Andrew asking, are you surprised at how quickly Reece has gone from quiet academy boy to one of the leaders in the first team? Is that a fair summary of how he is now, Liam, do you think?
Well, he's still a quiet academy boy off the pitch. it's tough getting a full sentence out of him in an interview, but he just becomes a different personality on the pitch. He's so imposing. I think he really intimidates his direct opponents. I think it was former Chelsea Academy boy, Ian Paveda, made quite a bright start when he came off the bench for Leeds on the right-hand side. Then he switched over to Reece James's flank and quickly wished he hadn't, because James was just bullying him, I think, at every opportunity. And he's just got such a physicality to his game. But also, one thing I noticed against Leeds was he's really looking to maximise that connection with the fans during games. He, more than any other player, was constantly playing to them, trying to get them going after a big tackle. Or when he put in the cross for Giroud, he actually celebrated his assist, wheeling away in front of the Chelsea fans before Giroud celebrated the goal. so he's got that kind of natural connection, as you would expect from someone who joined Chelsea so young. And he's such an imposing character. It's quite easy to imagine him as being a future Chelsea captain, at least on the pitch. I think he will need to come out of his shell a little bit off the pitch if he wants to do that. But Mason Mount has got a great personality in that sense as well. And he's very assertive on the pitch and has that easy connection with the fans. So Chelsea are in a really good place when it comes to looking for their next generation of leaders, which I don't think you can necessarily say even a year or two ago.
I know this is stating the obvious, really, and it should have dawned on me a lot sooner. And it probably did to a certain extent, but I've been doing a lot of retrospective stuff for a piece this week, a Chelsea piece, and looking back at over the Abramovich era, and this pining the club has had for ages to produce the next John Terry through its academy, someone who was going to be a regular in the team. And to sort of sit here now and watch the likes of Mason Mount and Reece James and Tammy Abraham establish themselves and just look so good and assured at this level, I mean, that is unbelievable. This is Chelsea's dream being realised here. And I know it's all contrived in various different circumstances coming together to allow them this opportunity to establish themselves. But also, you've got an awful lot of talent in that group of players. And it's been very, very well coached out of them in the academy system. We all know that Chelsea's setup is first class, but it just feels like a moment. You go back 3 or 4 years, I don't think it was, we could have foreseen this. Not when Chelsea were going out and spending lavish fees on the likes of Bakayoko and Drinkwater, etc. Now they've actually got real homegrown talent coming through, and that will benefit them for ages, and it sets a pathway in motion again. And I just think it's an unbelievably positive thing to witness.
Yeah, and actually, Simon, the captaincy thing, without wishing to get ahead of ourselves, is interesting. That red-haired dude wanted to know who will be the future captain out of Reece James and Mason Mount. And actually, it might not be that long before there is a new permanent club captain. If, you know, Azpilicueta's not playing much, Thiago Silva's 36 and Jorginho can't get a look in at the moment, it might be one of James or Mount soon.
Yeah, I mean, don't forget Conte as well. He's worn the armband, but he's not exactly a vocal leader. He sort of leads by example, as he did on Saturday. In fact, before I answer your question, I just think Conte and Thiago Silva also stood out for me. And I just think this is what's so encouraging about Chelsea, is that everything about them is a great blend. You've got the youth of Mason Mount, Reece James, etc. But you've got those experienced old stages that you need for any successful side, and those two, I think Silva's just on a weekly basis. I know I rave about him, but he was just class personified every time he touched the ball. And Conte, in fact, Bielsa said post match that one of the issues was Leeds couldn't get the ball off the centre halves or Conte, and I just think that was a very significant thing for him to say. But as far as the captaincy goes, I've said before that Mason Mount is for me sort of more of a potential captain. Reece James, I don't think he could handle the media part of the job. That would be the sort of the big cross against his name, being wheeled out on a regular basis in front of the likes of you, Matt. You know, it can be quite an intimidating experience, and unless he sort of changes that part of his game, I'm not sure you'd want to put him in front of the cameras. I know that's some might sort of be listening to this thinking, oh, you know, that's a pretty minor point, but it can be quite a significant one if you're sort of got that burden responsibility of speaking up for the team over sometimes some very delicate issues. And that's why I've sort of really noticed how Mason Mount is regularly wheeled out. Forget his performances, which have been really on the rise since the beginning of the season. But he's just very comfortable whenever Chelsea want to do any kind of promotional thing. There he is. He's regularly speaking post-match, pre-match. He just seems to be taking everything in his stride off the pitch as well as on it. And yeah, he's definitely getting ever more mature in front of our eyes.
Liam, did Frank Lampard say anything about Hakim Ziyech after the game? He went off in the first half injured.
Well, he confirmed it was a hamstring injury. I saw Ziyech come and sit down at the start of the second half. He looked pretty glum, and a member of staff came over and gave him an ice pack to put on his right hamstring. But it's too early to know the severity of it. By the time that you're listening to this podcast, we might have a little bit more clarity on the nature of the injury. I mean, Lampard's will speak before the Krasnodar game anyway. But it's clearly a big worry, because as many options as Lampard has, particularly in the attacking half of the pitch, let's not forget Callum Hudson-Odoi not even in the squad against Leeds for the second straight Premier League game. There isn't really anyone else that Lampard can call upon who does the things that Ziyech does. And I think he'd very quickly established himself as pretty much the creative hub of this team. And so at a stage of the season when you've got so many games in a short space of time, Chelsea will miss him, even though they do have an awful lot of talent to fall back on.
Dom, it comes back to the drum that you've been banging for a while. This is going to be a regular thing this season, isn't it? Unfortunately, it's not just Ziyech who's going to feel a hamstring go twang, particularly in this month of December when things are even busier than usual.
Yeah, spot on. I mean, it's a shame to lose him so early in this bank of fixtures, really, given the clutter that's to come. But that is the reality. And at least Chelsea have a huge depth of quality in forward areas that can can compensate. Well, they can make up for it to a certain extent. I know what Liam's saying. He is the creative hub, but there are options there. It might offer an easy way for Pulisic to get back into the team, or for Callum Hudson-Odoi to get back in, or even for Havertz to play in that role on the right. So there are ways that Chelsea can get around it, and they don't need to rush him back. But yeah, he will be missed still, because he's a player of that much quality.
We've had a few questions regarding Kai Havertz and his slow start to life in English football. Liam, you've been writing about your favourite subject for The Athletic.
I have. I've resumed my long-form dissertation on Kai Havertz and his career at Chelsea in my latest match piece. Essentially, the point of that piece was that, yeah, he's not playing brilliantly. I mean, I think he's playing better than his critics would give him credit for. If you look at some of his advanced numbers, he's creating chances for teammates and creating danger on a pretty consistent basis when he plays. But it's obvious that he's still feeling his way in Premier League football, the intensity of it, having that split second less time to make decisions. He's also still feeling his way as a number eight in this system, because we have seen him sort of shunted around a little bit, probably more than any other player, actually, as Lampard has tried to find the best configuration for this group of players. let's not forget that he also contracted COVID, and according to Lampard, he had significant symptoms. He wasn't asymptomatic. So I think we have to give him a little bit of time here. It's also worth remembering that, yes, he's one of the most expensive signings in Chelsea's history, but he's also younger than all of the academy players other than Reece James and Callum Hudson-Odoi, who are currently, starting on a relatively regular basis. So he's got plenty of time. And I understand there's going to be more scrutiny on him because of the size of the transfer and the hype that he arrived in England with. But there have been enough flashes of his talent, I think, to show that there isn't too much cause for concern.
I also think that it's not that big an issue whilst Chelsea are winning. Like if Chelsea were losing on a regular basis, then I think there'd be more reason to be concerned, or certainly more reason for him to come under scrutiny. In the best sort of way possible, the fact that Chelsea are winning without Havertz sort of playing brilliantly on a regular basis, I think it helps keep the pressure off him. I think it'll only become an issue for Havertz, or more of an issue for Havertz and more of an issue for Chelsea, if they start losing games.
Well, it's back to Champions League business for the Blues next. We'll look ahead to match day 6 momentarily.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So Chelsea already guaranteed top spot in Group E after thumping Sevilla last week. This ahead of the game against Krasnodar at Stamford Bridge on match day 6. We ought to have a quick reflection on that Sevilla game though, Simon. Is that one of Chelsea's best away performances in recent memory in Europe? I'm struggling to think of many better.
Yeah, I think given the history dictates that I think only Manchester City have won there in the Champions League. Yes, Sevilla was a weakened side. They had to change their goalkeeper at the last minute, but Chelsea also fielded a weakened side. Well, technically, made a lot of nine changes, and that demonstrated the strength of the squad. But it was about the attitude. They didn't treat it like a dead rubber. Yes, of course, there's top spot to play for, but it was exactly the kind of response that Lampard would have been looking for, majority of which were fringe players, to give him that response, to give him that headache. And of course, Giroud was the one that emphasised that point to the whole dressing room more than anyone else, that if you step up in what is considered a less significant game, that it can actually change your fortunes, and there he is starting against Leeds the next game. So I just thought the way they played, the attitude, the goals, Giroud's goals were amazing, but they could have scored more. Very, very impressive, and crucially secured that top spot in the group ahead of the draw next Monday.
In terms of Krasnodar on Tuesday, we won't spend a lot of time on the game because it will have happened by the time a lot of people listen to this podcast. Dom, though, it's such a rare thing for Frank Lampard to have. He can rest whoever he wants in this game. It's probably the only time this season he's going to be afforded this luxury.
Agreed. And I suppose he has to take into account things like players who are booking away from a suspension, and just a quick glance down Chelsea's squad list would suggest that Jorginho, Kovacic and Mount would be in peril. He'd certainly want those guys available for the first knockout fixture in the new year. So I'd be very surprised if any of them got anywhere near the pitch. He can experiment. He could play. I mean, he could even go as far as playing people like Lawrence and Andrew, and if he really wanted to. I mean, it's that much of an opportunity to rest weary limbs. I mean, I suspect part of Lampard's mentality will be he won't want to give up this or threaten this unbeaten run. But to be honest with you, Chelsea's second string should get past Krasnodar, whatever team that Krasnodar put out. So it's a perfect opportunity to give the likes of Billy Gilmore some game time. Kai Havertz again could get another run out to get some more games in game time in his legs. you know, the likes of Christensen and Emerson at the back, give them another chance to play. We know Azpilicueta is desperate for games. It is an opportunity for Lampard just to let these guys go out and express themselves and give him some food for thought for the festive period going ahead. You know, these are the fringe players that want to be involved at that point, so they need to state their cases against struggling Russian opposition at Stamford Bridge.
Just to say, it's just been confirmed that Billy Gilmore is the player speaking alongside Frank Lampard at the pre-Krasnodar press conference, which not always a hard and fast rule that the player talking plays in the game, but that makes it quite likely in my mind that Krasnodar at home could well become the Billy Gilmore show.
Do we see Tomori, do you think?
That's a good question. I mean, if he doesn't play in this game, when is he going to play realistically before January?
Yeah, it'd become much more difficult for Frank Lampard to pretend that everything was hunky-dory between them, I think, if he didn't play. The other interesting one, Simon, question here from Plurisic. Who do you think will start in goal, Kepa or Willy Caballero?
I'd be surprised if it's not Kepa, because Chelsea have to generate some kind of interest in him to remind everyone that Kepa still exists in many ways. And I'm sure Kepa himself would also be knocking on Frank's door saying, come on, you know, give me a chance, give me a game. I need to be playing. He must be very worried about his spot in the Spain squad for the European Championships, let alone sort of his club career. But of course, with the January window sort of around the corner, he'll want to put himself in the shot window a little bit just to remind everyone of what he can do. It must have been a really difficult time for him the last few months, not only sort of reflecting on how his form has gone, but to see Mendy just come in and sort of turn Chelsea's defensive record around, not single-handedly, of course, but Kepa sort of become the forgotten man, and for the world's most expensive goalkeeper to find himself in this position, it must be soul-destroying for him. So I would like to see him out on the pitch. I know some Chelsea fans might sort of be sort of freaked out at the prospect that the clean sheet sort of record and the run they're on might be in jeopardy, but I just think we're dealing with a human being here, and he needs to remind himself of what playing football is all about. So I hope he gets his chance.
Well, whoever starts against Krasnodar, one suspects Chelsea will be back to full strength on Saturday night when they head to Merseyside. We'll preview the game against Everton next.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
It's another 8 o'clock Saturday night kickoff for Chelsea this coming weekend as the Blues head to the Northwest for a reunion with Carlo Ancelotti and his Everton side. This one of Chelsea's poorest performances last season. A year ago this month it was. They lost 3-1. Mateo Kovacic with his only Premier League goal, a rare bright spot in that game. It was Everton's first game post Marco Silva and under Big Dunk. On Kovacic, here's Manu asking, how crucial is he to the first 11? Will we see him starting ahead of Havertz in important fixtures since Havertz is young and will need time to adapt to the league? An interesting one, Kovacic, Liam. He came off the bench against Leeds on Saturday, but he's really struggled to nail down a regular place this season.
Yeah, this was the other aspect of the match piece that I wrote after the Leeds game, was that the Giroud or Abraham conundrum got much of the limelight ahead of that game. But the other big selection dilemma that Lampard faces really now is Kovacic or Havertz as the third midfielder in that three, because N'Golo Kanté is entrenched at the base of midfield, and Mason Mount is playing so well that I don't think you can leave him out of any game that, that really matters at the moment. Kovacic has looked pretty good when he plays. I think he's looked to me as if he's making more of an effort to contribute in the final third of the pitch, because that's always been a big weakness in his game, making a lot more runs into the box. He's having a few more shots. He did try to recreate that goal he scored against Valencia in the last couple of games a few times. And we all know how good he is in possession and carrying the ball through the centre of the pitch. So he's a very good option for Lampard to have. I suspect that when Havertz is fully fit, Lampard will still give him every opportunity to grow into this team and into that third spot in midfield. But right now, I think it makes sense to favour Kovacic in the more difficult games when maybe Chelsea need that control in midfield as well, because that's the one thing that he really does provide that maybe Havertz doesn't quite at this point.
Dom, you were covering Chelsea when Carlo Ancelotti was manager. Of course, Goodison Park was the scene of his demise in terms of his Blues career. What will this game mean to him? Will there be extra motivation for him, or does that not really fit his character this, you know, 10 years on from him being sacked by Chelsea?
I don't think it will play a massive part in Carlo Ancelotti's approach to this match. I mean, he's come up against Chelsea once already just prior to lockdown, when they got thumped at Stamford Bridge last season. So I think the emotional bit with his association with Chelsea has probably been played out now. But there is, it's a nice thing to reflect on. I mean, he was a very, very, very popular manager at Chelsea. And I still look back, and I'm sure the Chelsea hierarchy and Carlo Ancelotti look back at that second season of his two and wonder quite how that bad moment extended for as long as it did, because bear in mind what he achieved with the double in his first season and the number of goals that Chelsea were scoring, and it was proper swashbuckling stuff, probably the closest Abramovich had ever come to seeing that ambition of having an expansive attack-minded side under his ownership, and for it to unravel in the way it did with that ridiculous, almost a three-month period in the middle of the season where Chelsea just couldn't buy a win and endured some pretty miserable and baffling results en route. Nobody saw that coming. But obviously, it was born of a variety of different things, from Ray Wilkins's departure to maybe a bit of upheaval in the transfer market in that January when Torres and David Luiz turned up. But it is a good story in its own way. But I still think people will look back at Ancelotti's time, and he behaved with such dignity throughout that, despite being effectively a dead man walking from the January, February onwards that season. He went out with a lot of respect. And when it happened at Goodison Park, I know Chelsea refute that it happened in a corridor, but it sounds as if, well, clearly that's where the conversation started, confirming his departure. It was a shame. There was a lack of dignity to that. But he still took all the players back to London. They went out to a restaurant, I think, that night, and celebrated his 2 year tenure with them. He'd made some really good friends and made a fantastic impression on the club. And it's not as if it held back his career particularly, did it? I mean, he went off to some pretty decent clubs in PSG, Bayern Munich, and I think Real Madrid after that as well. So he's not done too badly.
So fast forward a decade, Simon, he's back in the Premier League with Everton. Are Everton any good? They started the season really well. Now they've won one of their last seven. I can't quite make them out.
They're always good against Chelsea at Goodison Park. Certainly many, many times they're good. So I've learned a long time ago that always take Everton's form book out the window when it comes to hosting Chelsea. I was there a year ago, and I was pretty. I was already in a bit of a foul mood as it was, because it was an early kickoff on the Saturday, and it was the Athletic's Christmas do on the Friday night. So I couldn't attend because I wouldn't have been able to make it to Liverpool. So I remember sitting next to the Everton colleague, and we were both already bemoaning the fact that we'd missed the Christmas do. And then I watched Andreas Christensen and Kurt Zouma play like they'd attended the Christmas do as they got totally bullied. Now, Zouma's a different prospect now, but getting back to the point, there's me sort of having a personal rant about missing Christmas do's. They are a strange team, but this is Everton. They always seem to have a patch of form, then a reality check. It seems to be the way they've been the last few years. But in Calvert-Lewin, Chelsea have a real concern, a real striker to worry about. He still seems to be scoring goals. James Rodriguez, okay, he's gone a little bit quieter after a good start, but it's a player of undoubted quality. Everton do have the players to cause Chelsea problems, but you know Chelsea do have a lot of threats themselves. This will be a test, another test. I'm sure we'll be saying this on a weekly basis, but getting a win at Goodison Park has been proven in recent years to be a tough prospect for Chelsea, and of course Everton fans will be there, so for the first time for them, so it will be a tough afternoon for them, evening rather.
Do you think that you look at Chelsea's wide options though, even without Ziyech, and given that Everton have struggled, they've lost all their fullbacks to injury, they're going to be opportunities there for, I mean, if Alex Iwobi is playing left back and Ben Godfrey playing right back, I mean, now that they've lost Delph to a hamstring as well, there's a vulnerability there that Chelsea should exploit. I mean, they really should.
Unlike Simon, I did attend the Christmas party. Had a good time. And
that's
then
because I didn't attend.
Well, didn't want to say, but then was dreadfully hungover the next day and ended up watching the Everton game on my phone in a Nissan car dealership in St Albans while waiting to interview Jose Bocinga.
Oh, yeah, that was it. Oh, yeah. Not often you wake up in a Nissan car dealership waiting to interview Jose Bocinga, is it?
Oh, I didn't wake up there. That would have been a better story, though. I'll embellish that for next time.
Oh, well, who knows what state the chaps will be in when they're watching the game on Saturday night. 8 o'clock kickoff. We'll react to it next week. Elsewhere in Chelsea news, the men's under-23s beat Leicester 2-1 on Friday night. That thanks to a late Henry Lawrence winner. And the women's team earned a 3-2 win against West Ham in front of returning supporters at King's Meadow. That courtesy of a Sam Kerr hat-trick. Liam, she needed that.
She did, yeah. She's had quite a bad time in front of goal. Probably worse than Timo Werner over the last couple of months. But a bit like Werner, actually. Kerr has kept getting into the good positions. Her movement has always been excellent. And of course, you know, playing in this Chelsea team, she's always going to get that kind of service. So it was probably only a matter of time before she put in a performance like this one, but hugely encouraging for Emma Hayes and Chelsea women going well.
Absolutely. Right, that's just about it for this week. Before we go, let's hear what the chaps have been writing for Athletic subscribers to enjoy. Liam, you mentioned that you've been profiling Kai Havertz again.
I have. I've been talking about Kai Havertz, Mateo Kovacic and that number 8 position. That's on The Athletic at the moment, so make sure you give that a read. I'm working on a piece. I know I mentioned this in last week's podcast. It was put back a week, but it will be running this week on some Chelsea's academy boys and their dominant run in the FA Youth Cup. Memories of playing with Mason Mount, Tammy Abraham, Fikayo Tomori and the rest. So I'm looking forward to putting that together and give that a read when it goes up.
How about you, Simon?
Well, stuff you can read right now. I feel like my specialised subject, Olivier Giroud's Renaissance, I feel like I've written that a few times, but it looks like the encouraging sign is that him suddenly getting minutes post-international break has led to some kind of breakthrough U-turn, as it were, and he's much more inclined to stay now, which would be a huge fillip for Chelsea. So I talk about that. There's a piece I wrote on Jude Soonsup Bell, Chelsea's academy striker. I spoke to his parents, which was a very fun conversation. It was they're a very fun couple, interrupting each other. Couldn't have been more excited about their boy, and understandably so, because of course, I was talking about his FA Youth Cup exploits, and that sort of was one of the reasons why I did a piece. His 4 goals, the first Chelsea youth player to score in the Youth Cup, 4 goals for 59 years, and I got them to talk about his their son's love of Ronaldo and some of his growing up anecdotes, how he scored 13 goals against some poor man's 13-year-old son, who's probably still haunted by that to this day. And as for stuff I'm working on, it's a lot of it's for the future. So I can't really talk about that just yet.
Good tease. Dom, you've been looking at how Patrick Vieira's managerial career has gone to merd.
You got to reply in French as well, Dom.
Wow.
Pardon?
Wow. Yeah, yes. It hasn't gone so well for Patrick in the... I mean, he did get 2.5 years out of Nice, so it's not as if it's all gone pear-shaped in 6 months. It's been a slow progression, and this season has not gone well. There were 5 defeats on the bounce at Nice, culminating in their elimination from the Europa League last week to Bayer Leverkusen, and he got the chop on Friday. And it's just, I wrote a piece just asking, you know, what happens next to him, because he's still someone that's very, very well respected within the City football group for whom he coached at New York City prior to going to Ligue 1. He's got the next job he takes may have to temper his expectations slightly and lower the standards and maybe start rebuilding his managerial career at a lower base.
Good stuff. Remember, right now, if you subscribe to The Athletic, you can give another subscription as a gift for free. It's the perfect present for any football fan this Christmas. Wave goodbye to 2020. Say hello to 2021 by sharing the gift of The Athletic's unrivaled football coverage for the whole year. The perfect present for yourself and someone else. Just go to theathletic.com/ChelseaPod. That's theathletic.com/ChelseaPod and sign up now. Many thanks to Dom, to Liam, to Simon, and to producer Adonis, but mainly to you, listener. Stay safe. We'll catch up with you again next week. From all of us here, though, it's bye for now.